Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Jason Ingalls, the founder and CEO of a leading cybersecurity firm known as Ingalls Information Security. They're based out of Woodsworth, Louisiana. Jason, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started. We looked at your bio, and you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and how you got started in cybersecurity?
You bet. And first, let me just say that I kind of hit the lottery when it came to career choices. I've been building computers since I was about 12 and had always been an enthusiast and wound up using the knowledge I gained to self-study for certifications. So I got the MCSE way back in 2000. That led me to a systems administrator job, which led to a systems engineering job for a DoD subcontractor for an Air Force project. And I worked on that Air Force project for about 9 years. And in the meantime, commercial cybersecurity sort of sprang up around us. Right around 2001, we got asked to do our first penetration test on a financial institution. And so I was able to take the knowledge I gained from cybersecurity engineering at the DoD subcontractor and apply it to try to break into a financial institution. And, of course, once we'd done that, we were hooked. So we started doing a good bit of that at my employer there. That led to work with some of the other business units at General Dynamics. That's where my employment was, including the one that did TJX breach response. So you recall the TJ Maxx breach. So we got a chance to go in and actually assist on that breach. And, of course, once I saw the incident response work, it really captured my imagination and certainly realized how much I enjoyed doing it. So I was able to get some early industry breach response experience, kind of read the writing on the wall, as well as some technical testing with WhiteHouse.gov. Back in 2009, they launched WhiteHouse.gov on Drupal, which is an open source content management system. And I got to lead the security test team that basically broke that website every week for 6 months before we launched it in October of 2009. And, you know, as I tell a lot of folks today, I knew by having my name on the documentation that got approved for the security that I was either going to have a pretty good career or a pretty short career. And I spent a very nervous weekend waiting for Twitter feeds to say that the WhiteHouse.gov website had been hacked. Fortunately, through the entire lifetime of that website, it never got defaced or hacked. So it's been a great career so far.
Okay, well, that's awesome. That's incredible. Congratulations on that. Now, why did you start Ingalls Information Security, and what made you leave your previous jobs and start a cybersecurity company? Just the urge to be an entrepreneur or just to kind of like help the public? Or?
Yeah, well, there were a few things. First of all, I was at a point in my life where I could take that kind of risk. You know, I was able to get out on my own without worrying about making sure that, you know, the electricity bill got paid. So that's one very important part of anybody's decision to start a business is can you support yourself in the meantime? Secondly, I'd seen the writing on the wall with regards to incident response and how long it took for many vendors in that space to respond and actually get on site and start helping stop the bleeding and, you know, help the client. I mean, it just took weeks up to weeks to get engaged on something where, you know, the biggest criteria for success is how fast can you stop it. So I realized it was, I could build something that was small and agile and could respond a lot quicker. And today you can see that across the industry where people are engaged in hours. And you know, for example, we can engage and deploy worldwide in hours. But that was something that just didn't exist back, you know, back in 2010 when I started the company. And then finally, you know, I had a lot of opportunities sort of presenting themselves left and right. And I realized just how big of a deal that information security was going to be in the near future and realized that if there was ever a time to open up a store, put my shingle out, that was the time. So that's when I made the jump. And that was in summer of 2010, 8 years ago.
Okay. Congratulations. Now, how long has Ingalls Security been in business?
Yeah, since the summer of 2010. So I believe August So we're coming up, we're just over 8 years in business.
Okay. Now, does Ingalls Information have a presence in other countries as well, like overseas, like in India or Europe or Asia, anywhere around there?
We have a partner program where we have, for example, folks in Asia, South America, several different locations in Europe, where we have long-standing partnerships with people who can help us. Much of what we do today can be done remotely, and with data privacy laws of various different nations, there's also the considerations to be made about, you know, where that data is stored, et cetera. So we partner, for example, with people in South America to create a data repository and to help perform any work that may be required so that the data stays in the country of origin. And that happens across the world. So again, you know, we've developed those partnerships for years now. But we don't, all of our full-time employees are based in the United States.
Okay. Now, who's your typical customer that you're trying to target? Is it the small and medium-sized business, the large-scale companies like the Fortune 500, or perhaps a combination of both?
It's a combination, and that varies by business line. So we have four business lines. As I mentioned, you know, we did a lot of consulting initially. We did a lot of technical testing initially. Those are two business lines. We've done a lot of incident response over the last 8 years. That's the third. And then finally, in the last 3 years, we've been doing a lot of monitoring and preventative type activities. So when you look at each business line, you know, we do a lot of consulting for the Global 500. We do testing for everybody from a small community bank to a multinational, multi-billion-dollar company. We do incident response predominantly for the very large companies, although we do a lot of, you know, lately, especially with the business email compromise issues that we've seen over the last 8 or 9 months, we've been doing a lot for small business who got sold, you know, a cloud-based email provider that just didn't allow multi-factor authentication or it wasn't configured. So we've been seeing a lot of that. We just kind of run the gamut. We've got folks, again, very long-term relationships with folks in the Global 500 community, and then we've got people call us every day for help who are small businesses or small to mid-sized businesses.
Okay. Now let's get into your product line a little bit. What lines of business does your company offer?
Sure. Yeah, so we've got four lines of business. The first, as I mentioned, is consulting. Where we can explain, our job as a consultant is to understand what risk exists and communicate that risk to you so that you can communicate, you as the client, potentially, you know, that's usually an information security officer or even an IT manager or perhaps the CISO of a company, but provide the mechanism and the information necessary to communicate risk to leadership so that they can make informed decisions. And in addition to that, we can also deploy standards-based, for example, frameworks into an environment so that you can quantify the risk that you're dealing with in cybersecurity rather than just, you know, a green, yellow, red sort of qualitative assessment. So we deploy that for multinationals. Our consultants deploy framework for multinationals. We do risk assessments. We have an audit capability for financial institutions. And then from there, you know, the other business line that sort of goes hand in hand in many engagements with consulting is our technical testing. And these are the folks who basically get paid to break into places legally with a get-out-of-jail-free card, if you like to call it, or a rules of engagement document that says these people are authorized to do it. But we break into places and then explain how we did it so that those clients of ours can fix the problems that let us break in the first place so the bad guys can't do it. And then of course, incident response is something that we've been doing since the business was founded, and even prior to that for many of the folks that do it for us. Incident response is one of those situations where the driver is the amount of time it takes to resolve an incident and to contain and remediate attacker presence and data theft or destruction. And so we've worked on some very, very large engagements around the world. We've worked on some very small engagements for folks who, you know, maybe a CPA firm that had an intrusion and needs to understand what kind of data was accessed or even stolen by an attacker. And then that's the incident response line. The final line of business is the managed detection response, line, which is a preventative effort. In other words, we put in a layered set of cybersecurity controls into an environment, and we manage those as well as respond to incidents that need to be remediated. So the goal there is to find intrusions, because you're never going to be able to stop them all. You do what you can to stop as many as you can, but there will always be the case where, you know, an intrusion can occur. If it does, our job is to identify it as fast as possible, map the thing out rather than just, you know, stopping a piece of malware, understand how the malware landed on a computer, for example, or what user account was involved or what computers on the internet are involved. And once you've got that mapped out, you can kill that entire attack chain and prevent any future intrusions from occurring using the same vector or the same method that you just mapped out. And if you can do that before the attacker can leverage that intrusion to cause harm to our clients, then we've done our job, and it's as if the attack never occurred. And so that's our goal, part of MDR. But that gives you a kind of a rundown of all four business lines.
Sounds awesome. Now, can you tell us about your application called Viewpoint? Can you describe that in more detail,
sure,
please?
Yeah, you bet. So Viewpoint is comes from an idea that occurred to our then CTO, Adam Richards, back in 2012, where we were in Atlanta hunting down some bad guys in a very large computer network. And Palmer Luckey had come up with the idea of crowdsourcing a virtual reality headset called Oculus. And I'm sure many of the listeners are probably familiar with Oculus Rift, but back then this was pretty big stuff. I mean, no one had really figured out how to deliver VR hardware to the masses. Well, they figured out how to do it via crowdfunding, you know. So they kickstarted the Oculus program. And our CTO at the time said, hey, you know, it'd be great is if we could, like, see packet data in three dimensions so that we could see more of it. Because one of the biggest problems that we have whenever you're an incident responder is just being able to understand or gain situational awareness about the environment that you're working in. And the first job you have when you get on site and you're working a breach, or even if you're remote, is to take as much data as you can and cram it into your brain so that you can get situational awareness. What does the environment look like? How many web servers are there? How many database servers are there? How many users and how they interact? We thought that it would be better if we could present a model rather than ask people with varying degrees of technical capability to interpret data as you read it and try to, you know, put this model together in your head. It would be better if we could just create this model based on the information that's available in many of the breaches that we work. So we took that a step further and we said, okay, well, how would we do this? And we're going to need a big database, and you know, we're going to need if we're going to put it in the Oculus, we need to have the right engine. And you know, we spent years trying to figure out how we would do it. By 2015, we had a prototype that we unveiled, and also a patent application that we submitted in August of 2015. The day after which, at Black Hat, we unveiled the Viewpoint prototype to the world, and you know, got some strange looks because people are like, well, okay, how's this supposed to work? But the way it works is it basically visualizes every actor and every event in the cyberspace that you can actually, that we have data for. So, for example, if we have data from our clients in a breach response, or if we have data from our clients that are using our MDR service, log data, flow records, IDS alerts, endpoint alerts, threat intelligence data, I mean, the list goes on and on. But if you have all that data, then you can correlate that data in a visual manner. And that's basically what Viewpoint is. It's a visual sim, which allows you to see things. By the way, it's a standard model now instead of the one that's between everybody's ears who are reading this data in a traditional sense. But if you can see this data and I can see the same model that you're looking at, then all of a sudden we can discuss cybersecurity in a standard manner and we can get to a resolution a lot faster. So what our analysts are able to do today, for example, with Viewpoint in our MDR solution, is carve off a lot of time that would be traditionally used literally switching between windows, whether that's browser user interfaces for cybersecurity tools and search tools and ticketing tools and all this other stuff. We can simply see it all at the same time, carve the stuff that actually matters to the investigation that we're doing, and then export that as a ticket that needs action. And so that's what Viewpoint does. It is three-dimensional, meaning that it's four-dimensional, which means that we can We can look at a time series of data in a three-dimensional environment, and it works with both virtual as well as augmented reality devices. So we gain an extra dimension to show data, whereas everybody today, in every legacy tool that presents cybersecurity data, it's in two dimensions. And, you know, I like to use the analogy of looking at cybersecurity tool output today is kind of like watching a baseball game through a drinking straw. You might be able to see the pitcher wind up and pitch the ball, but by the time you try to look to see if the batter hit it, the ball's in play. And there's just not enough information coming through that user interface to give you the situational awareness you need to make rapid progress in investigations. Viewpoint is our attempt to fix that so that we can show the entire environment as a backdrop so that you gain situational awareness about, you know, which computer's talking to which computer. You can automatically see, for example, the DNS server or the mail servers or the domain controllers or file servers just based on the patterns of traffic that you can see naturally. And then you overlay that with the various discrete pieces of information. Like I said, with regards to intrusion detection systems, you know, you have IDS alerts that you can layer on top of all that information. So you can see the breadcrumbs that analysts use to put together a map of an intrusion. And again, that's the goal, is find the intrusions, map them out, and get them stopped before they create damage or impact. But that's Viewpoint in a nutshell.
Okay, cool, awesome. Now, do you have any customer success stories you'd like to share with us?
Absolutely. We can basically walk down the lane of every single business line that we have and talk about things. I mean, we do some pretty cool stuff. We don't have a large marketing budget. And what I mean by that is, you know, you don't see our name on billboards and airports. But what we can tell you about are the things that, and again, what we can tell you about, there are a lot of things we can't, are for, you know, organizations that are out doing a lot of good. We do a lot of work with nonprofits. We do a lot of work with small businesses that, you know, need our preventative capability to do their jobs and not worry about cybersecurity. So as far as customer success stories are concerned, you know, I guess where I can start is a trading company that works on a trading board that had us in to do a penetration test. So these folks they're basically trading stocks. You know, they have an online trading platform that allow their customers to trade stocks. They got a lot of clients. We were able to go in and figure out that they had a pretty badly configured web application that allowed us to gain access to their entire production environment. This was on Saturday at about 2:30 in the morning. We were testing after hours. Just so that, you know, we don't have any potential impacts to the production environment because most people aren't using it at that time. But we were able to get in at 2:30 a.m. I called this person who was our point of contact for this client and said, hey, look, you know, we found a real big problem, and we're not sure we're the first people to find it. And that's what we're trying to figure out right now. But in the meantime, you need to get your team together, and you need to close this big hole that we got. So that was an example of us finding a major problem for a client that asked us to test their environment and find abilities. Well, we found one, and it was pretty enormous, and it got fixed in a quick hurry, and they really appreciated our ability to just instantly reach out, get it resolved, and, you know, notate that in the test that, hey, we found this, it got fixed in an hour and a half, and that problem's closed. That shows a lot of value to the client, and obviously shows the kind of risk management that a good penetration test engagement can provide. So that's an example of testing. With regards to consulting, we have helped large multinationals deploy the cybersecurity framework so that they can evaluate where their risk areas are. We have been to, for example, we've been to places around the world to do assessments and site surveys to understand where the risk is in those remote offices for companies based in the United States. And we've helped them understand, you know, what they need to do to manage that risk. From MDR's perspective, I mean, we've stopped intrusions that were in progress, and we're able to explain to the client, you know, what needed to happen, why it happened the way it did, and basically prevent loss. And we've got several stories like that. I'm not going to be able to get specific because I don't, you know, the last thing our clients really want is for us to tell everybody that we're their cybersecurity bender. You know, it's just not a good idea. That being said, I can tell you that we've solved for a lot of these kind of problems for lots of different clients in the MDR space. And then with regards to incident response, we've been able to prove that an intrusion was not did not lead to data exfiltration. So we were able to explain that, yes, this client, this incident response, this breach victim had an intrusion, and we could see exactly what the attacker did. They got in, they looked around, they couldn't find anything. Unfortunately, they didn't see all the personally identifiable information on the database that they were actually connected to, and we could just show that. That's not something that a lot of forensic firms have that capability, but that's not something that you can necessarily guarantee whenever you go into an incident response. But that's certainly something that we look for, because if we can explain that, yes, there was an intrusion, but that, you know, fortunately, there is zero evidence that the attacker was able to access sensitive data or something that, for example, might trip a legal requirement to notify people, then we've done a good job for them, because we've been able to clearly explain what happened and clearly describe what their liability is as a result of that. So that's kind of a rundown of various different success stories that we've been part of for our clients over the last 8 years.
Okay. Now, obviously, there are tons of cybersecurity vendors out here in the United States. What separates Angle Security from other vendors? I think you alluded to a little bit in the last question, but could you maybe elaborate just a little bit more?
Yeah, you bet. Well, first, let me just say that there's just not enough people in cybersecurity right now. There's 360,000 open jobs as of about a year ago. So, you know, there's not enough folks out there. One of the things that separates us from the rest of the people in the, you know, the rest of the companies in cybersecurity industry is that we've been around for a while. This was cybersecurity wasn't something people talked about very often in 2010. In fact, it was information security or information assurance, which is why, you know, you don't see cybersecurity in our business name. We've been around for a while, and there are others who've been around longer, but we've been around through the sort of the big news items. And we've been part of many of those big news items when it comes to breaches. We've got hands-on experience in identifying nation-state-level intrusion events and helping to remediate and clean up and then prevent future occurrence of some of the most gnarly cybersecurity events that you will ever read about. We were hands-on in many cases on some of the ones that you've heard about in the news. So that kind of breach experience and the amount of knowledge that we've gained as far as what things broke, when the breach occurred, which controls didn't work, which controls could have worked had they been configured correctly, and what was that right configuration, and how should these things have worked, and, you know, what was the design and where did the design fail? Those are the kinds of things that I think set us apart from most of the rest of the cybersecurity industry, just because we can take that knowledge and use it to build something like Viewpoint, for example, or our MDR offering. I mean, the capabilities that we deploy in our MDR, for example, are directly they're derived from the experience and knowledge that we gain in breach response. So the tools that we're using are things that we know work because we've used them in breach response. And, of course, we've matured those tools over, you know, the last 3 years. So I would say our length of time in the industry, the amount of specific knowledge we have with regards to where things go wrong in cybersecurity risk management and our ability to fix them and most importantly, prevent them where possible. That's what sets us apart.
It sounds awesome. Now, do you offer your customers like a free trial or a free risk assessment before they decide to go ahead with a purchase order or a buying decision?
Yeah, we do offer a proof of concept. Most of our clients at this point understand the value. But we do have a few every once in a while that would like to do a proof concept. And we also have a partner program that we offer for example, managed service providers. So the good folks out there fixing things. I mean, we partner with lots of MSPs, and our job is to find things that they fix. Again, our job is to figure out what those intrusions look like, map them out, and then get them in front of somebody who can fix that problem and make sure that it gets resolved as fast as possible. So in those cases, for those MSPs, you know, we're kind of a show-me type organization. So we'll go plug in our MDR offering and give give our potential partners the kind of service that they're going to wind up reselling to their clients. We want them to know that whenever we plug our stuff into their clients, that their clients are getting the best they possibly can. So a proof of concept makes sense. That's, again, for the sort of NDR client. We also offer case studies and, you know, white papers for folks who are looking at things like risk assessments. You know, why does a risk assessment make sense for us? And, how would that go? How would we execute a risk assessment? What's the approach look like? So from the consulting side, we've got white papers and other resources that we can provide our potential clients so that they can understand where we would benefit them.
Okay, sounds good. Now, do you have a partner program? Like, do you partner up with other cybersecurity companies or other tech companies?
That's right. Absolutely. So our partner program is primarily focused on the preventative side of the business. You know, we kind of lump things into preventative. That would be consulting, testing, and MDR, and then reactive, and that's the incident response side. Although we do partner and sub, for example, a lot of times we'll be a subcontractor for a very large breach because, you know, our friends and partners from years of working in incident response will call us and ask us to help them solve a hairy problem. But, we can jump in and work with other incident response firms. We do that quite a bit. But we certainly partner with other technology firms, especially, for example, those that are out there managing IT infrastructure. So we will go out there and, you know, assist their clients, our job being to identify what risk exists, whether or not that risk is being realized. In other words, if there's an intrusion or a compromise or if there's just data being exposed to the Internet when it shouldn't be. And then providing that to our partner, that situation with all of the things necessary to fix it to our partner. And of course we also, you know, are able to prevent a lot of that stuff with some of our technology, but we partner with folks so that we can offer a full scope solution from risk identification, management, and resolution for issues that are discovered. As far as consulting is concerned, we partner, for example, with a lot of folks that do government work, so they'll have to have, as part of their government contract, they'll have to have a cybersecurity assessment of that project, and they'll have to have a documented system security plan, for example. Some of the things that I did for WhiteHouse.gov back in 2009, we still do a lot of that in partnership with some larger firms that are, you know, for example, standing up websites for large departments in the U.S. government. So we partner with a lot of different people for various reasons, and it allows us to focus on what we're best at, which is cybersecurity risk management.
Okay. Do you have like a VAR, like a value-added reseller program for a model for your sales?
Yes, we do. That's right. And, I assume that we're going to be talking about the website, but there's a link on the website where you can go and just click and ask about being a partner, and we'll get back with you.
That just sounds cool. Now, I've seen on your website talking about that you have done case studies on business email compromise, also known as BEC and ransomware. And as you know, these are some of the big cyber threats out there. Can you elaborate more about this in your work?
Yeah, you bet. In fact, this is something that we decided to put on the website recently just because of the volume of incidents related to business email compromise lately. So first of all, let me just define what that is. So business email compromise is unauthorized access to data stored within the email system of a business. The most common example of that today is where a business has employees that are logging into a cloud-based email system, so Office 365 or Google G Suite, you know, what have you. There's several out there, but they will be, you know, logging into this, and they don't have multi-factor authentication enabled on their account, which means if they get compromised, for example, via a phishing email that they click on and go to a website and type their credentials into, anybody, anywhere in the world can log into their cloud-based email service without having to, you know, provide any validation other than their username and password, which, of course, they just gave up. Now, once they're in there, they've got access to their account, all the data that's inside their email inbox and outbox and any other box. But more importantly, for the attackers in some of these complex business email compromise situations, they get to go look at the address list for that organization. They get to look at the address list for anybody that this user that they've compromised has ever sent an email to. So now they have a whole new set of targets. And let me ask you a question. If you got an email from somebody within your organization asking you to do something to help them, do you think you'd be more likely to than if you got an email from somebody outside your organization? Well, the answer is you're going to try to help your coworker do their job. And so what these the attackers know this. So what they're going to do is they're going to send certain select people in the organization. By the way, they've already figured out who these people are, what their title is, and what they're responsible for. So they'll send the purchaser an email from a compromised internal account. The purchaser, for example, will get that and say, okay, well, Jill just needs me to help her do her job, or, you know, just this so that she can get what she needs done. So I'm going to do that. And they wind up getting their account compromised. Now, once the attackers have gotten to a privileged title position, so, for example, the purchaser, what they can do is contact that company's vendors and say, hey, we'd like a refund on this. Or maybe they will contact the company's clients if they're working with the accounts payable or the accounts receivable folks in the business. If they're able to compromise the accounts receivable people, and they could say, hey, we're going to send you a new invoice, and we've changed our routing number and our bank account number. So please, from now on, pay us via this bank account and this routing number. We've seen a lot of that happen. And then what happens is, a month later, they're doing an audit, and they realize, hey, we missed 30 days worth of accounts receivable. And then slowly they figured out that it looks like you sent an email out saying, hey, change this. And then people will go, well, I didn't send that. And that's when they call us because they realize they've been breached. So that's an example of a business email compromise. There's a lot of different kinds of examples of it, but it all sort of revolves around unauthorized access to a compromised user's inbox and email account, and then what attackers can do once they've got access to that.
Okay. Now, can you provide an example of a specific cybersecurity threat that you help the customer mitigate?
Yeah, just give me a second. Let me think about it. There's several.
I'll take your time.
Yeah. Would you like to talk? Are you talking about incident response or maybe just risk management? I can talk about several different kinds. Consulting, testing, I shared with you with the testing that we were able to identify a critical vulnerability through a penetration test that would basically allow carte blanche access to a trading organization's prevention. So that's one example, but incident response wise, I can tell you that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So for incident response, let me think. There's quite a few. We've had, for example, we had a client who was an advertiser, online advertiser, and their job was to basically put ads on websites that had signed up to receive some form of payment whenever somebody clicked on an ad that was on this advertiser's web advertising solution. Interestingly enough, there was some political activity around unions up in Wisconsin. This was a few years ago. And the attackers in this case were capitalizing on the fact that people were visiting a website. They broke into this advertiser's syndication capability for ads, injected some Java drive-by download script that basically allowed people to, if they visited the site that this ad was being displayed on, their computer would then go download some malware. And so you can imagine that a national news item would drive a lot of traffic to, for example, in this case, the union webpage up in Wisconsin where there was a political fight going on. There was a lot of traffic on there. And this advertising syndication capability that our client had was compromised. And so everybody that was going to this website was getting their computers compromised by this drive-by download thing. So we were able to go in, first of all, and investigate and understand exactly what was going on because people were, they had, our client had a lot of different folks, very angry folks calling them and saying, hey, you guys hacked my computer. You owe us money. You, you caused malware download. I've got all these problems. Well, we were able to figure out exactly what happened, how it happened, able to put a stop to it, and then make sure that our client was able to address the various claims the right way by giving them the data as to what happened, when it happened. So, for example, some people were just making claims that were spurious, but, if it wasn't within this time frame and if it wasn't as a result of this particular piece of code, then it didn't happen at our client site. So we were able to get very specific and provide forensically sound evidence to our clients so that they can use that to their advantage whenever they're dealing with the fallout of being breached. I mean, there's a lot of potential risk that gets realized in a breach response. One of those is reputational risk. I mean, we've worked with clients that have taken several black eyes over the kind of breach response or emergency situation that they've had to deal with, where they've been breached. They told everybody, and then they got breached again, and they told everybody, and then they finally called us, and we rolled in and figured out what was the root cause, so that they could then go tell people the whole story. People tend to react better whenever you can explain from a root cause perspective what happened, why it happened, how it got stopped, and why it's not a problem anymore. And we've got several examples where we've done that.
Okay, sounds incredible. Now, let's just shift gears now and talk about the cybersecurity threat landscape in general now. On other points, we keep hearing about Russia in the news all the time and their potential to meddle again with the midterm elections. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, every time I look at the news headlines every morning in cybersecurity, there's something about Russia coming out about some elections or something. I mean, what are your thoughts on that in general?
Yeah, so first of all, we're talking about a different level of geopolitical intrigue, we'll just call it, okay? This is a meta level, this is a very high level attempt by nation states to influence other nation states' populace by manipulating the information that they get, manipulating what they do with that information. And so, for example, you see the kind of headlines where, Russia, for example, tampering with the United States during 2016 elections, and then, of course, the threat and concern about the midterms. I mean, these are things that they didn't just pop up in 2016. They've been going on for a long time, I can tell you from experience, especially over in Europe and Eastern Europe. There's been a lot of that kind of activity. We've been involved in some of that stuff. Bottom line is it's basically psychological operations with a bit of a twist, because you're using highly technical sources and methods to manipulate information for a target audience. And, this isn't new. The mechanism is new. And maybe that's what's got everybody kind of spun up about this. But if you can understand the mechanism, then you can understand how to resolve those kinds of problems. And I think that's happening right now. I mean, if you look at where, for example, Facebook, some of the things that they've said about what they're trying to do to identify this kind of activity, the fact that they actually did identify it a couple of months ago, called it out, the response to this seems to indicate that people are getting their head around it, and they're starting to realize how, for example, Facebook, how Facebook was used to meddle in election process, or with Google's instance, how Google and their advertising might have been targeted and leveraged as part of an information campaign by people who are trying to meddle in international affairs or the election process of other countries.
Okay. Now, what are your plans for expansion for your company? Are you planning to offer other new products and services, or do you want to enter newer markets?
Yeah, what we want to do is we want to scale, right? So when we started 2010, we were primarily consulting-based, although we did a lot of testing. So consulting and testing were the two primary business lines. We added the incident response a couple of years later we got called in to do a couple of very large breaches in 2012. And then based on all that experience, we built the Managed Detection Response, or MDR, solution. That is our scalable answer to cybersecurity need for business. And we built that specifically to scale. And so we're super focused on making sure that we can deliver the most good to the most amount of people at the lowest cost possible. And so that is our solution. Is, you know, we can plug in our controls into a corporate or any organization's environment and manage cybersecurity risk within acceptable parameters at a price point that you certainly couldn't do yourself, nor does it exist anywhere else today. I mean, we're doing things at half to a third of the cost of what you do it yourself, and that's, again, because we're scalable. So our focus is strictly on scaling that capability, the Managed Detection and Response Service. We'll continue to do consulting. We'll continue to grow to some degree in consulting and testing and incident response. And of course, incident response is going to continue to evolve as the speed to response and resolution gets better for across the board. We think we've got a good handle on, for example, getting the tools necessary to investigate deployed really quickly around the world, getting resolution really quickly, and we'll continue to evolve that. But our biggest focus is on growing the managed detection response client base, again, because we can replicate that kind of value to multiple clients, and so that's our focus.
Okay. Now, obviously, we know that the cyber threat landscape is changing, like, on a daily basis, even almost by the hour. How is your company, Ingalls Security, going to keep up with all of this?
Well, that's a great question. There's a few ways. First of all, we get to see where bad things are happening, right? People call us when bad things have already happened. We get to go in and investigate and figure out, hey, you know, this is fileless malware. That was a kind of a big deal last year. Is we're looking at a lot. I mean, fileless malware has been around for a long time, but you take Eternal Blue exploit and you plug that onto a PowerShell script, and you take some other web-based capabilities, and you got yourself a brand new toy that can do all kinds of amazing things. We saw a lot of that last year, especially with the crypto currency miners. So that's an example of how things are changing. But again, we get to see that because we get called in to go fix problems, and that's when we discover, hey, it's a brand new tool. Or it's a brand new capability. So we get to see that. And believe me, the cyber threat landscape is accelerating as far as change is concerned. I mean, we saw things in 2012. We saw the same tools 2 years later, basically the same framework that were used by the same kind of threat actors in the same areas of the world. And those tools had evolved significantly in 2 years. Those same threat actors are still out there cranking out brand new capabilities. And again, one of our biggest claims to ability to stay abreast of that is that we get to see it because of some of the clients that we work with. I mean, for example, we work with nonprofits that are out there helping spread the kind of, you know, ideas that are ensconced in the Bill of Rights. Okay. So there are places in the world that certainly don't want that to happen. And guess who's coming after those nonprofits? The nation state arm of, you know, the cybersecurity attack capabilities of nation states are going after nonprofits, for example. So we're able to see some pretty advanced capabilities deployed pretty early on, as opposed to, for example, the commercial world. I mean, some of the tools that we saw deployed against nonprofits in, say, 2013, 2014 evolved and got deployed into commercial environments a couple of years later, just because of the mission of some of our nonprofit clients and what that put them up against. So we get to see a lot of that. And again, I think that's the cyber threat landscape is going to continue to evolve at a faster pace.
Okay. Now, from my research, and maybe I'm wrong, I do a lot of reading and writing about the cybersecurity industry, and I've noticed a shift now, the cyber attacker, where they're not going, like, after servers and emails and, like, passwords. They're now want to do, like, physical harm to an actual infrastructure of a city. So, I mean, I read some headlines where cyber attackers that have actually set off, like, tornado alarms. They've done other things like that to actually damage, you know, do some potential damage to an infrastructure. Do you think that's going to be now the new shift for the cyber attacker?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look back over the last 10 years and see where that's just become more prevalent. And here's why, in my opinion. It's because every day we trust computers for a little bit more. We trust computers and information technology, and the infrastructure of the world trusts those computers to make them more efficient, to deliver the kinds of goods and services that as a civilization we depend on to be delivered just in time, for example. So as we continue to trust information technology, more and more for more important things. You know, now we have pacemakers that have connections that allow remote management. But as we trust this capability, you're going to continue to see people find the ways, the other ways that this technology can be used and to create harm rather than to deliver good. That's just not going to change. There's always going to be a way to leverage technology to do things that it wasn't intended for. Okay, the problem and the reason this is going to continue to get worse is because we're just going to keep using technology for more and more important things. We're going to continue to trust it for more valuable activities, more valuable things. We're going to trust it with people's lives. We already do it. We're going to continue to do that more and more. And again, the problem there is that this technology may do that really well, but what else does it do? And how is it leveraged to create impact where it's desired by bad actors? So that's just going to continue to get worse, unfortunately.
Okay. Do you think cyber threats are just going to plateau out one day? I mean, cyber attackers going to say, hey, I'm bored. I've had enough of this. I'm going to move on to something different, like maybe hijacking your plane or something. I mean, is this going to all like plateau out and maybe evolve into something else? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, let's put it this way. I believe somebody at the FBI said not too long ago, only an idiot will rob a bank with a gun today, right? Because there's plenty of capability to steal money from financial institutions using the internet and computers. So I think that there's just going to be no. The answer is absolutely not. There's going to be a lot more activity by a lot of various capable threat actors, whether that, you know, they're script kiddies or they're nation-state capable, nation-state sponsored, organized crime. I mean, you name it. That's just going to continue to grow. Why? Because there's opportunity. There's opportunity to leverage technology to do things that it wasn't designed for. And until we fix that problem, and by the way, I don't see that getting fixed anytime soon, this is not going to do anything but get worse. As far as, you know, hackers getting bored, I mean, I think, first of all, hacker, the term hacker was originally not designed to connotate that, you know, this was a criminal. It was somebody who figured out the shortest path to an answer. And that's the opposite of bored, right? That's an enthusiast who is looking to get to the end goal as fast as possible. That's what a hacker is. Now, people think of hackers today as criminals, and certainly people who are criminals will always try to find the shortest path to whatever nefarious objective they have. Those are enthusiasts. They're not going to get bored at this.
Okay. Now, what do you think the biggest cyber threat will be out there? Is it going to be like ransomware, Bitcoin? What do you think the biggest threat to the average U.S. business will be?
Well, I think in the near term that user applications, the application space is going to continue to get worse. I think that, for example, the lack of multi-factor authentication is going to be the biggest problem in the next 2 to 3 years for organizations that lack it, but just because there's such low-hanging fruit. I mean, if an attacker knows that you don't have MFA installed, they're going to do what they can. They're going to be persistent in their attempts to compromise users in your application layer, such as email, and then from there commit all kinds of tomfoolery and create all kinds of problems for you. So I think that the user application layer, so to speak, is gonna be where most of the problems are. Now, down long term, I mean, you know, it's really anybody's guess, although I would say that as artificial intelligence and machine learning capabilities ramp up, I think you will probably see some sort of arms race maybe within the next 10 years where you've got, you know, I mean, today you can buy, quote, artificial intelligence, machine learning solutions for cyber defense. And in some cases, maybe I don't know this, but it's possible that you could buy artificial intelligence agent systems that could be used for attack or for, you know, criminal activity or for geopolitical activity. Don't know yet. All I can tell you is that that's probably just over the horizon if it's not already here. And I think what you'll see is potentially an arms race condition where, you know, you've got defenders and attackers each using artificial intelligence to try to outsmart the other. One thing's for sure, things are not going to do anything but get faster, and that's really the best use case for AI, as far as I can tell, in cybersecurity, is to do things faster. So there's a natural inclination there to leverage the technology as a as a way to improve your capabilities. So, yeah, I see that coming over the horizon if it's, again, if it's not already here.
Here, well, finally, you know, we're in the business of helping the customers out and, you know, so forth. Everybody's giving recommendations. What's your number one tip or tips that you can provide at the close of the show for people to protect themselves from a cyber threat or a business? Just like off the top of your head, like what can we do? I mean,
absolutely. I'm glad you're asking. Yeah, no, I'm glad you're asking for this because you know, I try to do this every chance I get to talk to people. I mean, step one is understand your information technology environment. What how many computers do you have, you know, as a business owner? And I'm talking mostly to business owners because government agencies, they should have a checklist that they can follow for this kind of stuff. But for a business owner, understand what it is you're using technology for. It may be that you don't need to use as much technology, or maybe you need to use better technology. But certainly do not use remote access or cloud services unless you are using two-factor or multi-factor authentication mechanisms. So if you don't have a username, something you are, a password, something you know, and a token, something you have, like something on your cell phone with a, you know, that you can punch a number in with, or an SMS text, even though that's not as effective, then you need to get that immediately. If you're using Office or Office 365, G Suite, or any other cloud-based email service, and you don't have multi-factor authentication, as I just described, then you need to get it. Second is to understand how social engineering works, because, again, I just see this as very prevalent, and I see this as not being something that's going to resolve itself over time, but understanding how email social engineering attacks work, just training, getting some training around what to look for, getting some testing for your organization to say, hey, you know, we had 100 people at the organization, 9 of them looked at the email and 3 of them clicked on it. Well, it's not bad, but, you know, that means, you know, chances are you're going to have an intrusion. So and working down from there, getting better at that. And then finally, making sure that you have a trusted advisor in cybersecurity. So somebody who, if you've got a question, you can go to them, and they may not have the answer immediately, but they'll figure it out because they're an expert and you trust them. That would be the third thing. Is make sure you have a trusted advisor in cybersecurity.
Okay. Well, Jason, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it, and we look forward to us hopefully speaking with you again in the near future. Thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.